Chapter 5. The Second Harbinger, the Terrorist. The figures on the seal, Noriel, what did they look like? She asked. Men with beards, in robes, and with some sort of head coverings. Their beards were squarish and heavily stylized. Some were holding bows and arrows and aiming them upward, all very ancient-looking and alien. So how did you unlock the mystery? By the runes of an ancient people, that was the clue. The figures on the seal had to be the ancient people he referred to. That much seemed obvious. But which ancient people? Who were they? So what did you do? The Metropolitan Museum. It's filled with artifacts of ancient peoples, and it's enormous. So I figured that whoever these people were, if they were of any historical significance, their artifacts would be on display in that museum. I would go there with the seal, hoping to find a match. And it was as impressive as I hoped it would be, with artifacts from Egypt, Rome, Greece, Persia, Babylon. I started with the Egyptian wing on the first floor, but nothing matched. Then I searched through the Greek and Roman wing, but again, no matches. Then I made my way up the grand staircase and over to the Department of Ancient Near Eastern Art. That's where I saw it. It was impossible to miss. It was gigantic. What was gigantic? She asked. Massive stone walls covered with reliefs of giant figures, warriors, priests, and a number of creatures, part human, part bird, composite creatures. I took out the seal and compared the figures to those on the wall. They were the same figures, the same squarish beards, the same clothing, and all in the same style of artwork and engraving. It was a match. An exact match? It wasn't the same image, he replied, but it was the same people. The same civilization. So who were they? They were the ancient Assyrians. And what did you make of it? I didn't have time to make anything of it. I was studying the images on the wall when I heard a voice from behind me. Walls from the palace of Ashurnasirpal, king of Assyria. I'd assumed it was someone who worked for the museum or some other expert. I continued staring upward at the ancient figures. From the city of Nimrud, 9th century B.C., the voice continued. Impressive, I said, not being able to contribute anything more informative or substantial to the conversation. The runes of an ancient people, replied the voice. With that, I knew it was him. And he knew you'd be there? Either he knew I'd be there, or I was there and he happened to be there, or he was there and I happened to be there. I stopped trying to figure out how it worked. I turned around, and there was the prophet, standing in his long, dark coat in the Department of Ancient Near Eastern Art. If you didn't know who he was, you wouldn't have noticed. He blended in. You go to museums? I asked. Does that surprise you? He answered. Why wouldn't I? I don't know. I just didn't picture you. I told you it would be by the ruins of an ancient people. How many ruins of ancient peoples are there in New York City outside of museums? So what have you discovered? It's the Assyrians. The ancient people are the Assyrians, and they have something to do with the Second Harbinger. Good, Noriel. Now let's go deeper. What do you see? What do you mean? Look at them. How do they strike you? Kind of stony. And what do you think lies behind their stoniness? I have no idea. And with that, and with an assurance one would expect from a museum tour guide, he began introducing me to the history of this ancient people. They came from the mountainous regions of northern Mesopotamia. For centuries they lived in the shadows of stronger kingdoms. But at the dawn of the first millennium BC, they began their rise to world power. They began their conquest of the surrounding lands and people. The Assyrians would march into Babylon, Syria, Lebanon, Persia, and Egypt, until at the peak of their power, most of the ancient Middle East was under their rule. So what kind of people do you think they were? Militaristic? With the largest army ever to stand on Mesopotamian soil up to that time. They devised new technologies of warfare, the movable tower, the battering ram. Their empire was a war machine, built on the subjugation of other nations and kingdoms. They were among the most brutal people ever to have walked the earth. The very mention of their name inspired dread throughout the ancient world. But why such dread, I asked. Other nations have been militaristic. One word, said the prophet. Terror. The Assyrians made terror into a science. They systematized it, perfected it, and employed it as no other people or kingdom had ever done before. They burned cities to the ground, mutilated their prisoners, flayed alive those who rebelled against them, and nailed their skins to the wall for public display. The Assyrians were the masters of terror. And what do they have to do with the mystery? It was the dark shadow of Assyrian terror that loomed over the kingdom of Israel. This was the danger against which the prophets warned, and it was only the hedge of God's protection that was keeping that danger at bay. But that was about to change. With a nation's descent into apostasy, it was no longer safe. It was the Assyrians, I said. They were the ones who caused the breach. Correct, he replied. In 732 BC, with the nation's hedge of protection lifted, the Assyrians invaded the land of Israel. So that must have made it all the more terrifying for the people of Israel, that it was the Assyrians. Exactly. There couldn't have been any clearer warning of the coming judgment than that. And when, years later, Israel's final judgment came, the Assyrians would again be the means through which it would happen. But you're not saying that God was siding with the Assyrians. Not in any way. This is the prophecy he gave concerning them. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. I will send him against an ungodly nation. Yet he does not mean so, nor does his heart think so. But it is in his heart to destroy and cut off not a few nations. The Assyrians were the epitome of evil, and God was against them. The prophecy continued, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria, and the glory of his haughty looks. Therefore the Lord of hosts, will send leanness among his fat one, and under his glory he will kindle a burning like the burning of a fire. The Lord would bring the Assyrians into judgment. Their empire would vanish from the earth. But for a time, in the days of Israel's apostasy, they would be allowed to breach its defenses and strike the land. If the Assyrian attack failed to awaken Israel from its spiritual stupor, then what could? It was then that he asked me for the seal. I placed it in his hand. He then began revealing its mystery. The second harbinger, he said, as he held up the seal so I could see the figures engraved on its face. An enemy strikes the land. The attack is plotted out by the merciless and executed by the brutal, designed to traumatize the nation, to inflict shock and fear, terror, the sign of the Assyrian, the second harbinger, the terrorist. The Assyrians were terrorists, I asked, as much as any people have ever been. Terrorism is defined as the systematic application of terror, violence, and intimidation to achieve a specific end. Terror, as an applied science, this was the dark gift the Assyrians gave to the world. We began walking along the stone reliefs, continuing our conversation while gazing up at the ancient figures above our heads. From the temples of Nineveh to the beer halls of Weimar, Germany, to the barren caves of Afghanistan, from Sennacherib to Osama bin Laden, it all goes back to ancient Assyria. The Assyrians are the fathers of terrorism, and those who mercilessly plotted out the calamity on 9/11 were their spiritual children, another link in the mystery joining America to ancient Israel. In both cases, the warning began with a manifestation of terrorism. Did the 9/11 terrorists see themselves as modern-day Assyrians? It doesn't matter, said the prophet. That's what they were. Remember the prophecy against Assyria. It is in his heart to destroy Osama bin Laden and cut off not a few nations. That was his intention. But God would judge the Assyrians and their king. Then all those responsible for 9/11 are under his judgment? I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria, said the prophet. Yes, they are under his judgment, and the Lord will send leanness or devastation among his warriors. So the Assyrians are the spiritual fathers of Al-Qaeda. Yes, and not only the spiritual, he replied. And what does that mean? The Assyrians were children of the Middle East. So too the terrorists of 9/11. The Assyrians were a Semitic people. So too the terrorists. The Assyrians spoke a language called Akkadian, The tongue is long extinct, but there is still spoken in the modern world one language considered to be the closest of all tongues to ancient Akkadian, which is Arabic. Arabic, the tongue of Al-Qaeda and the 9/11 terrorists. Yes, and so when the leaders of Al-Qaeda plotted their attack on America, and as the terrorists communicated with each other on 9/11 to carry it out, they did so using words and speech patterns that mirrored those used by the Assyrian leaders and warriors as they planned and executed their attack on Israel 2,500 years earlier in 732 BC. Like an ancient drama replaying itself in the modern world. He didn't reply. We continued walking along the stone reliefs. It was strange. As I stared up at the ancient stone figures, I began to feel a sense of loathing toward them on one hand and some kind of dread on the other. The Assyrian invasion, said the prophet, would ultimately draw ancient Israel into military conflict, war, and a final and tragic national drama. So too, the attack of 9/11 would draw America into military conflict, a global battle against terrorism, encompassing a war in Afghanistan and another in Iraq. In the first war, the connection to 9/11 was clear, but in the second, it was not so clear. And yet there was a connection, but of a more mystical nature. What do you mean? In April 2003, American soldiers would enter the Iraqi city of Mosul. Mosul would become one of America's major operational bases in the Iraqi war. Inside the city, near the junction of the Tigris and Khosr rivers, there rest two mounds of earth. One is called Koyunjik, the other Nabi Yunus. Hidden inside these mounds are the ruins of a once great civilization. The ruins are all that's left of the ancient city called Nineveh. Nineveh was the capital, the final resting place, and the graveyard of the Assyrian Empire. Assyria is Iraq? It's the same land. The nation under judgment is drawn into conflict with the land of Assyria, ancient Israel, now America. And American troops were now walking the same earth on which the feet of Assyrian soldiers had once marched. And among those watching them pass by were those who could still claim to be the descendants of the ancient Assyrians. Their actual flesh and blood descendants, I asked. Yes, he replied. And who knows but that the veins of the 9/11 terrorists did not also flow with the blood of the ancient Assyrians. So ancient Israel, in its time of judgment, was drawn into war with Assyria, which is now Iraq. Yes, he answered. And now America was drawn into a war with the land of Assyria, Iraq. But Israel would ultimately discover that the danger it faced could not be solved by the power of its weapons or the thickness of its walls. The real danger was not outside its gates, but within them. When the nation turned from God, it lost its protective covering. Apart from a return to God, there would be no safety. But by the time they realized it, it would be too late. The chance was lost. He stopped walking and pointed upward to the figure above him on the relief, a giant Assyrian archer. And now, the same sign that signaled the judgment of ancient Assyria 2,500 years before reappears in the modern world, no less dark and no less threatening, the sign of the Assyrian, the attack of the terrorist. And what does it mean for America, I asked. That is the question, he replied, isn't it? With those words, I sensed that our meeting was drawing to a close, and I was right. He handed me the next seal, the seal of the third harbinger. And what was on it, she asked. Shapes, unrecognizable shapes. This one may be a bit more challenging for you, said the prophet, in a voice conveying both caution and sympathy. So help me out, I replied. A word, he said. What do you mean? You'll need a word to decode it. What kind of word? The word that you need. Do you enjoy being so mysterious? I asked. It's not a matter of enjoyment, he explained. It's the nature of the job. Do you realize you've never even given me your name? Would that make a difference, Nouriel? No, I guess not. But shouldn't a journalist know who his source is? And you don't know who your source is? He asked. I didn't answer. I suspected it was a loaded question. He resumed his studying of the ancient figures on the stone relief. I did likewise, but not for long. When I turned again to ask him for something more to go on, he was gone. I looked around in every direction, but there was no sign of him. I was alone again. Just me and the Assyrians, in whose presence I was growing increasingly uncomfortable. I left the museum in search of the third harbinger. But it would be a search that would lead me to far more than I was expecting. What do you mean? She asked. It would lead me to the key that would unlock the mystery of all the harbingers. Chapter 6. The Oracle. I couldn't make sense of what was on the seal. It was some sort of composite shape, mostly rectangles, joined together in a chaotic jumble. I decided instead to focus on the clue. On the word, she asked? Yes. Pretty vague for a clue. Yes, but it was the only other thing I had to go on. So where do you find words? In a book? And where do you find books? In a library? So my search took me to the library, the New York Public Library, the one with the two stone lions standing guard outside and millions of books and resource materials inside. I was there virtually every day for weeks, going on any lead I could think of, searching for anything that would match the puzzling image on the seal. And did you find something? No, but one day I was searching through a book of symbols in the main reading room, sitting on a wooden chair against one of the library's long wooden tables by the light of a reading lamp under a massive window and a chandelier. I took a break to look up from the page, and there he was. The prophet? Sitting on the other side of the table, directly across from me, silent, just watching me. I had been so engrossed in the book, I never saw him sit down. How long have you been here? I asked. A few minutes. Why didn't you say something? I was waiting. So this is the place of our next meeting. I wasn't sure I was on the right track. You're not, he replied. And this is not the place of our next meeting. If this isn't the place of our next meeting, then why are you here? I countered. And why am I here? And why are we meeting? I would call this an intervention. I'm intervening. You're off track, and you need help. Then the word isn't in this place? It is in this place. Then how could I be off track? It is here. But you didn't have to come here to find it. In fact, you didn't even have to leave your home. But if it's here, I don't understand how I can be off track, or why you would have to come to intervene. I came to help you find the third harbinger, and to give you the key to unlock all the harbingers. I'm listening. The nine harbingers, what are they? He asked. Signs, warnings, given to a nation in danger of judgment. And to whom did they first appear? To the people of ancient Israel. And when did they first appear? At the time of the breach, the first invasion. So then that's where you need to look, Noriel. In 732 BC, when the Assyrians invaded the land, that's where the word is. What does that mean? A word was given, a prophetic word. The word I've been searching for? Yes. With that, he reached into the inner lining of his coat and pulled out an object, a roll. He placed it on the table and carefully began unrolling it under the incandescent glow of the lamp. It appeared to be an ancient parchment on which were written words of an ancient-looking script. It looks like a piece of the Dead Sea Scrolls, I said. It was the nearest thing I could think of to describe what I was seeing. It does, he replied. But it's not a piece of the Dead Sea Scrolls. No, but close. What is it? He didn't answer. But passing his finger over the parchment, he began reading aloud the ancient words. Davar, Shalach, Adonai. Which means what? I asked. Davar, a word. Shalach, has been sent. A word has been sent, I repeated. Adonai, the Lord. A word has been sent, Lord? A word has been sent by the Lord, he said, correcting my translation. Davar shalach Adonai, the Lord has sent a word, v'Yaakov, to Jacob, and it has fallen upon Israel, and all the people will know it, Ephraim and those who dwell in Samaria, who in pride and arrogance of heart say, what? What I'm about to read, Noriel, is the message given to ancient Israel in the days after that first attack. In this lies the key to unlock all the harbingers. How? By revealing their mysteries, the key to the nation's future, the future of ancient Israel, and the future of America. Once again, he began passing his finger over the scroll and reciting its ancient words. This is the message, said the prophet. Listen carefully. Livanayim, the bricks, Nafalu, have fallen. Vigazit, but with hewn stone. Nivne, we will rebuild. Shikmim, the sycamores. Gudau, have been cut down. V'erazim, but with cedars. Nachalif, we will plant in their place. The bricks have fallen, but we will rebuild with hewn stone. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will plant cedars in their place. It wasn't what I expected him to say, Noriel said. What did you expect, she asked. Something relevant? Something of significance? What did bricks and sycamore trees have to do with America? Or anything? And I told him. I don't understand, I said. I don't even know what it's saying. How is it the key? This is Israel's response to that first invasion, the first calamity. These are the words that sum up the nation's spirit, a spirit of pride, defiance, and arrogance in the face of the calamity. And why is that significant, I asked. Because these are the words that seal the nation's course and foretell its future. I'm not seeing it. What exactly is it, Noriel, that they're really saying? In the aftermath of the invasion, they're going to rebuild. And why would that be significant? I have no idea. It's what you do when something's destroyed, you rebuild. Look deeper, Noriel. What's the larger context? A nation is turning away from God. Its hedge of protection has been removed. Why? To cause them to turn back, to wake them up, to save them from a greater judgment. And what are they doing in light of it? Or rather, what are they not doing? They're not returning to God? Exactly. Instead of listening to the alarm, instead of turning back, instead of even pausing for a moment to re-examine their ways, they boast of their resolve. It wasn't about rebuilding at all. It was about ignoring the warning and rejecting the call to return. So they missed their warning. They did more than just miss it. They defied it. Notice the words. They weren't vowing just to rebuild what was destroyed, but to make themselves stronger than before, to become invulnerable to any future attack. So what they're saying is this: we will not be humbled, we will not search our ways, or consider the possibility that something could be wrong. Instead, we'll defy the calamity, we'll beat it back, we'll rebuild, we'll undo the damage as if it never happened. Not only will we not change our course, we'll pursue it now with even more zeal. We'll come out of this calamity stronger than ever and rise to even greater heights than before. They were saying all that in those few words, I asked. That's exactly what they were saying. That's exactly what it means. The alarm had sounded, and they were vowing to silence it. And what happens, Noriel, if you silence an alarm? You keep sleeping? And if the alarm was to warn you of a danger, what then? Then the danger becomes even more dangerous, because now you have nothing to warn you that it's coming. Exactly. So they kept sleeping. They nullified the alarm that was meant to wake them up, to save them. And it was all there in the vow. The bricks have fallen, but we will rebuild with hewn stone. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will plant cedars in their place. These are the words that seal a nation's destiny. The fate of an entire nation hanging on so few words? And in the original language, even fewer. 8 words. But how? I asked. The vow was a sign, a manifestation of the hardening of their hearts, the rejection of God's calling, the sealing of the nation's defiance and its course, and thus the sealing of its end. So the vow itself is a sign of judgment. Question. You told me that the word I was looking for wasn't just here in this library, that I didn't have to come here to find it. How could I possibly have found that parchment without you showing it to me? It's not the parchment, he answered. It's the word. And the word is from a book, from the book of a prophet. A prophet who lived at the time of the invasion and through whom the word was given. And the prophet was Yeshayahu. I've never heard of him. You have. You just didn't know his real name. You know him as Isaiah. Isaiah. The word is from the Bible, the book of Isaiah, the 9th chapter, Isaiah 9:10. Isaiah 9:10, so it's known. Not really. It's a very obscure verse. Even most of those who read the Bible every day would have little idea it even existed. So what does all this have to do with America? The prophecy in its context concerned ancient Israel, but now as a sign, it concerns America. How? It's the sign of a nation that once knew God, but then fell away. A sign that America is now the nation in danger of judgment, and now given warning and the call to return. So it was originally given to Israel, but now it's given as a sign to America. Yes. So if that same prophetic message, that same warning of judgment, once given in Israel's last days, should now manifest itself in America, it will be a sign that America is now the nation that once knew God but then fell away and is now in danger of judgment and now given warning and a call to return. So, if that word should be manifested in America, it becomes a harbinger of America's future? A harbinger, he answered, and more than one. The 9 harbingers. Yes, the 9 harbingers. Each one joined to the ancient prophecy, each one joined to this word, and each one carrying a revelation. If these harbingers of Israel's judgment should now reappear, along with this prophetic word, then the nation in which they reappear is in danger. And you're saying that they have reappeared? Yes. All of them? All 9. And they've all reappeared in America? Yes. And they all concern America? Yes. And Isaiah 9:10 is the key to all of them? Yes. It's the key that unlocks each of their mysteries and joins them all together. Each of the harbingers is connected. Each, when joined together with the other 8, forms a prophetic message. Each mystery is itself a puzzle piece in a still larger mystery. So 2 of the harbingers you've revealed. What are the other 7? Ah, he replied, that would be telling. It's for you to find them. And it's for you to help me. I have. I just gave you the key. You could give me a little more to go on. He paused, as if carefully pondering every word that was about to proceed out of his mouth. Then, just as carefully and deliberately, he began to speak. 2 of the 9 you already know, the breach and the terrorist. These form the context. As for the other 7, 1 is of stone. The other is fallen. One ascends. One is alive. The other once was. One speaks of what is, and the other speaks of what would be. There was a long pause before I ventured a response. You know, I said, I'm not telling you how to do your job, but this would all be a lot easier if you just gave me a map and a few subway tokens. You don't need a token. You have the key. And what do I do with it? You use it to find the third harbinger. Chapter 7. The Third Harbinger, The Fallen Bricks. We got up from the table, left the reading room, and made our way down and out the library's front entrance. So this time he didn't vanish at the end of the encounter, Anna observed. No, either that or it wasn't the end of the encounter. We started down the front steps. That's when it hit me. We were standing right under one of the lions when I realized it. That's where I stopped to take out the seal and look at it once more. I have it, I said. You have what? He asked. The third harbinger. I know what it is. And what is it? It's the bricks from the prophecy. From Isaiah, the bricks have fallen. That's how it begins. The image on the seal. That's what is in runes, fallen bricks, a pile of fallen bricks. Very good, Noriel. Now tell me what it means. It would be the runes left in the wake of the Assyrian invasion. Correct. When the Assyrian attack was over, the people of Israel began surveying the damage. What they found were the runes of collapsed buildings, heaps of rubble and fallen brick. The bricks had fallen. They were fragile to begin with, bricks of clay and straw, and dried in the midday sun. Any building made of these would be especially vulnerable to destruction. So the pile of fallen bricks became the most visible sign of the calamity, and of the fact that the nation's existence now rested on shaky ground. It was now vulnerable and in danger. The breach had been made, and the destruction, though limited, had begun. So the rune heap of fallen bricks was a sign, I said, not just of what had happened, but of what would happen if the nation didn't change its course. Exactly. The sign of collapse. The collapse of a building, the collapse of a kingdom, and then of a civilization. He asked me for the seal, and then lifting it up, he began to explain its meaning. The third harbinger. Enemies enter the land and cause destruction. The destruction leaves the nation traumatized, but the scope and duration of that destruction are limited. The most visible signs of the attack is the rune heaps of fallen bricks, stone, and rubble where once had stood a building. The bricks have fallen. The third harbinger, the fallen bricks. Ground zero. As the dust of September 11th settled on New York City, people emerged to survey the damage. The World Trade Center had collapsed into a colossal heap of ruins. As Americans watched on their television sets and computer screens, the image of the colossal rune heap at Ground Zero became the most visible and identifiable sign of what had happened. A strange image, several stories high, surreal and haunting. In the days and weeks that followed, the image would be seared into the nation's collective consciousness, a sign of destruction, though, as with ancient Israel, a destruction limited in scope and duration. And yet, as in the ancient case, the rune heap would serve as a sign against the nation's sense of invulnerability. America was now vulnerable. The breach had been made. The stones were coming undone, and the nation's security was resting on shaky ground. But the World Trade Center wasn't made out of clay bricks, I countered. The effect, though, was the same. The ancient prophecy opens up with the image of collapse, the ruins of fallen buildings. It was the same image of collapse and of the ruins of fallen buildings that confronted America in those first dark days following September 11th. The American towers fell with the same suddenness as did the clay bricks and buildings of ancient Israel. In a matter of moments, they'd become a heap of ruins. And yet the connection was still more literal. What do you mean? The rune heap of Ground Zero was filled with steel, concrete, and glass, but not only that. With what? Bricks. As in the bricks have fallen. The fallen bricks of ancient Israel comprised a warning concerning the nation's future. So too the fallen bricks of Ground Zero. The World Trade Center was a symbol of America's economic power, proud, majestic, towering. But in a matter of moments, it had come crashing down to dust, a warning to even the most proud, majestic, and towering of nations that no nation is invulnerable or exempt From the day that its power comes crashing down to Earth, even in a moment's time. The bricks have fallen. It's not just about destruction. It's about a nation's response to destruction, its vow of defiance. So how did America's reaction to 9/11 compare to that of ancient Israel? Do you remember the days that followed 9/11, he asked. Of course, I answered. No one had to say it. It was as if almost everyone had some sort of sense about it, even if they couldn't put it into words. It was as if the nation had unconsciously heard a silent voice calling it to be still and to return to the foundation. The voice of God? Yes. And for a moment, America appeared to be responding. The rush and clamor of its culture were stilled. Wall Street came to a standstill. Hollywood grew silent. Throughout the nation, there was a noticeable and massive turning away from the superficial and to the spiritual. Even the name of God was taken out of the closet and publicly proclaimed from Capitol Hill to New York City. Multitudes sang, "God bless America," and gathered for prayer. America's houses of worship overflowed with throngs of people seeking to find solace. In those first few days and weeks after 9/11, it seemed as if there might be a true national turning, a changing of course, an awakening, even a spiritual revival. But then America was turning back to God? No, America was not turning back to God. It was a spiritual revival that never came. And even the appearance of turning back was short-lived. It had no real root. There was no real change of heart or course, no searching of ways, no questioning if something could be wrong, no repentance, so it couldn't last. And it wasn't long before the moment was lost, and things began to return to a form of normalcy. The calls for prayer would fade away. The rush and clamor of daily life would resume. The spiritual searching would be abandoned, and the superficial again embraced. The name of God would again be withdrawn from the public square, and most of those who had suddenly flocked to houses of worship would cease their flocking. The nation would resume its departure from God and its rejection of his ways, only now with increased speed. So how did America's response to 9/11 compare with Israel's response in Isaiah 9:10? It was the same. From one commentary? The commentaries are writings on the Bible explaining the meaning verse by verse, but not the Bible. Not the Word of God, but commentary on the Word of God. So you study commentaries, I asked, surprised at the idea of it. I have. I just didn't picture a prophet studying the... And why not, he replied. Is God not able to speak through such things? I guess he is. One commentary on Isaiah 9:10 describes how the people of ancient Israel viewed their national calamity. There is no way for the people to ignore the obvious disaster, yet they choose not to recognize its deeper meaning. They do not respond to God. They only respond inadequately to the threatening situation. Take those same words and bring them into the 21st century, and you have a description of post-9/11 America. So then it would mean that in the wake of 9/11, America only responded to the immediate and obvious situation, to the destruction caused by the calamity, and to the danger it threatened, but never considered that there could be anything deeper, no significance behind the obvious. The bricks have fallen, but that was the point. Another commentary on the ancient vow puts it this way. The people declared the prophet, did not take this calamity as a judgment from God, but hardened their hearts and declared, "The bricks are fallen, but we will build with hewn stone. The sycamores are cut down, but we will put cedars in their place." Then America was shutting off the alarm. Yes, silencing the alarm meant to awaken it. Did anyone realize it? Some, while others sensed something more, something deeper, but couldn't put their finger on exactly what it was. But the alarm had sounded. The nation was in danger. Its bricks had fallen. Its stones were loosening. It was only the beginning. The bricks have fallen is only the opening of the ancient vow. There was more of the mystery to unfold. It's what happened after 9/11 that would prove even more ominous. It was then that he opened his right hand, exposing the next seal. "The seal of the fourth harbinger," he said, as he handed it to me. This one, Noriel, is different. The seal? No, he answered. The harbinger. Unlike the first three, the fourth harbinger was conceived on American soil, and it wasn't set in motion by the nation's enemies. Then who set it in motion? American leaders. American leaders? Yes. And how will I know it? It's hard to miss. It's the largest one. Chapter 8. The Fourth Harbinger. The Tower. Can I get you something else? She asked. Something other than water? No, I'm fine, he replied. I apologize. I should have asked you when you first came. The water's fine, he replied. So, she said, changing her pace and tone, he gave you the seal of the Fourth Harbinger, and what was on it? Images and markings, just like the others. But its central image looks something like the Tower of Babel. And how would you know what the Tower of Babel looked like? She asked with a trace of friendly skepticism in her voice. I don't, he replied, but I've seen pictures of it. The image looked like a ziggurat, a terraced tower with each terrace or story getting smaller and smaller as it rises. And what did you make of it? I didn't know what to make of it. I looked up everything I could on the Tower of Babel, but there was nothing I could find to connect to the seal. So I went back to the vow in Isaiah 9:10, but there was no mention of a tower. I was going nowhere. As you were before. As I was before, except then I didn't realize I was going nowhere. This time I was going nowhere and knowing I was going nowhere. I guess it was some sort of improvement, but it's easier to go nowhere when you don't realize that's where you're going. So what did you do? I put the two clues together, the image on the seal, with what he told me. What he told you was what? When I asked him how I would know the fourth harbinger, he told me it would be hard to miss. It was the largest one. So there's the image of a tower, and the clue that the fourth harbinger is the largest one, the largest tower. So I went to the largest standing tower in New York City. The Empire State Building? Yes, to the 86th floor, and outside to the observation deck. It was early evening, a windy day, just around sunset, with thousands of lights just beginning to appear through the cityscape. I walked around the deck, gazing at the skyscrapers in every direction, but there was nothing that struck me as being especially significant with regard to the clues. I was standing on the south side, looking out to the city's lower end. To my left was a man viewing the same scene through one of the metal telescopes they have there, the ones you have to pay to look through, the ones with timers on them. Impressive, the man said. It's an impressive view. Yes, it is, I answered. So many towers. When I heard the word towers, I turned around. It was him. The prophet, looking through a telescope on the observation deck of the Empire State Building? The same. And you didn't notice him before that? I was looking at the view, not the people, and his face was hidden behind the telescope. But his voice. Yes, but out of context, I wasn't expecting to hear it. The prophet continued. It has a beauty to it, he said, still gazing at the scenery. A strange beauty. Don't tell me you just came up here to take in the view, I said. Actually, I had an appointment, he replied. There's no point in me asking how you do all this, is there? I asked. My guess is that it involves satellites. I was being facetious, of course. You're right, he said. That it involves satellites? No, he replied. That there's no point in asking. How long have you been here? Long enough, he answered. I was wondering when you'd get here. The clue on the seal, it's a tower, right? It is a tower. Then I have it right this time. It's the Empire State Building. No, he replied. You've gotten it wrong again. What do you mean? It's a tower, the largest tower, and you're here. The image on the seal is a tower, but the Empire State Building is just the place of our meeting. But you said it was the largest one. The largest of the harbingers. Then the fourth harbinger isn't a tower? I didn't say that, but it isn't this tower. How many towers do you see out there? I have no idea. Many. And to which one do you think the seal points? Just then he looked up from the telescope. His time was up. He turned to me. Do you need some change? I asked, half facetiously. I'm okay, he answered. He began walking along the deck. I walked alongside him. He turned again to take in the view. I did likewise. So we both stood there in the wind, looking out at the vast expanse of skyscrapers, more and more of them now dotted with yellow lights and set against the deep red and blue background of the sunset sky. "And where were you now on the deck?" she asked. "Still on the south side, facing Lower Manhattan." "Noriel," he asked, "where are we in the prophecy, in Isaiah 9:10? "The bricks have fallen," I replied. "That revealed the first harbinger, but where are we now? What comes next?" "The bricks have fallen, but..." "But we will rebuild," he said, completing the sentence. "That's the key to the fourth harbinger." "Doesn't sound very revealing. Remember, it's not just the words, but the context surrounding them and the spirit behind them. The problem wasn't the rebuilding. The problem was the spirit and the motive behind the rebuilding. They'd just been given a critical warning, but they respond with defiance. But we will rebuild is the first declaration of that defiance, from which will come their judgment. It doesn't only say we will rebuild, I added. It says we will rebuild with hewn stone. Hewn stone, what's that about? What's the significance? The fallen bricks were made of clay and straw. They were brittle and flimsy. They would be replaced, but not with more clay bricks, but with something much stronger, hewn stone. So a building made of stone would be much more resistant to any future attack. Exactly. And it could rise to greater heights. So the hewn stone signifies their intent to come out of the attack stronger than they were before it. Yes. Again, all about defiance. Instead of being humbled by the calamity, they become emboldened by it. They vow to build bigger, better, stronger, and higher than before. Not only will they continue on their course of apostasy, now they'll do it with a vengeance, with defiance. So instead of bowing their heads before heaven, they raise their fists against it. "So what happened?" I asked. "They clear away the heaps of fallen brick and rubble and begin the reconstruction on the ground of their devastation. The project is filled with symbolic meaning. It represents the nation's rebuilding of itself and its rise from the ashes. The vow would become reality. New buildings, stronger, taller, bigger, and better, would rise up in place of those destroyed in the attack. So the new construction would become a concrete manifestation and witness of the nation's defiance of God's call." Taking the seal in his right hand and lifting it up, he began to explain. "The fourth harbinger. In the wake of the calamity, the nation responds without repentance, humility, or reflection, but with pride and defiance. Their leaders vow, we will rebuild. They pledge to rebuild bigger, better, taller, and stronger than before. The rebuilding takes place on the ground of destruction. The construction is intended to be a symbol of national resurgence. It is set to rise up from the ruins of that which had fallen and to surpass it in height. It will be their towering testament of defiance, the rebuilding of the fallen and of the nation itself, the fourth harbinger. The tower. So if the ancient mystery is joined to America, then somehow 9/11 has to be linked to the words, we will rebuild. Correct. In the wake of their calamity, the leaders of ancient Israel proclaimed, we will rebuild. The first sign of defiance. If the mystery holds and has now applied to America, we would expect to hear the same vow, the same three words, in the wake of 9/11, now proclaimed by American leaders. And did it happen? Did they say it? Yes, they said it. Not that it wouldn't have been natural to speak of rebuilding, but the way these three words continuously came forth from the mouths of American leaders, spoken over and over again as public proclamations, was striking. From the mayor of New York City in the wake of the attack, we will rebuild. From the state senator, we will rebuild. From the state's governor, we will rebuild and we will move forward. From the state's junior senator, we will rebuild. From the city's mayor at the time of the rebuilding, we will rebuild, renew, and remain the capital of the free world. From the president of the United States, we will rebuild New York City. One way or another, each leader would end up proclaiming the same words of defiance proclaimed thousands of years before by the leaders of ancient Israel. And as with ancient Israel, it wasn't just the speaking of the words. That's correct, Noriel. The words were followed by action. So what happened after the words were spoken by the American leaders? The words were likewise followed by action. The ruins of 9/11 were cleared away. Then a sign appeared at Ground Zero with these words: "A new icon will soon rise above the lower Manhattan skyline, the Freedom Tower." The tower! Exactly. It would become the center point of the rebuilding. And the sign called it an icon. It was meant to be a symbol of the rebuilding of Ground Zero and the nation. It was to be an icon of defiance. Defiance. The word comes up again and again in the commentaries. Listen. It is the defiance of a people who, far from being repentant, glory in their iniquity. To be heedless when God is speaking by whatever voice he may address us is surely iniquitous enough, but to act in deliberate defiance of the Almighty is by many degrees worse. Proud defiance of God always brings disaster. Long before the rebuilding began, while the dust of the attack still hovered above the ground of devastation, an American senator would foretell the meaning of the future campaign. "I believe one of the first things we should commit to, with federal help, that underscores our nation's purpose, is to rebuild the towers of the World Trade Center and show the world we are not afraid, we are defiant." "Is it about the leaders then?" I asked. "No," said the prophet, "not specifically." "Then about those making the proclamations?" "No," he repeated. "These are prophetic reenactments, or prophetic manifestations, the first of many. And though they involve people, they're not about the people involved. Those involved act unwittingly, without realizing what they're doing, as representatives of the nation, agents of a national spirit. These are prophetic signs of and to a nation. So the campaign to rebuild was not about any one person or any group of people. It was the will of a nation, the manifestation of a national spirit. One journalist would describe it this way: rebuilding Ground Zero was going to be America's statement of defiance to those who attacked us. A statement of defiance, exactly what the ancient vow was, a statement of defiance and boasting. From the commentaries: "They rise upon the ruins of their broken homes, boasting that they will show the enemy, whether God or man, that they can take it." 2,500 years later, the governor of New York would proclaim the same thing from the pavement of Ground Zero: "Let this great Freedom Tower show the world that what our enemies sought to destroy stands taller than ever." From the words of the commentary on Isaiah 9:10, "They boasted that they would rebuild their devastated country and make it stronger and more glorious than ever before." From the words of the mayor of New York in response to 9/11, "We will rebuild. We're going to come out of this stronger than before, politically stronger, economically stronger." "These were all verbatim?" asked Anna. "Actual quotes?" "Yes." "And what did you think when you heard them?" "It was eerie. Modern American leaders voicing the same things voiced in ancient Israel, and words that had to do with judgment. It was eerie." "And what else did he tell you?" "He spoke of the difference between restoration and defiance." "Which is?" "To replace bricks with bricks is restoration," he said. "But to replace bricks with hewn stone is defiance. To rebuild what was destroyed is restoration. But to boast of rebuilding stronger and greater than before is defiance. The fourth harbinger is not simply about rebuilding what was destroyed, but it must specifically involve rebuilding bigger, taller, stronger, and better than before. That distinction is clear in the scripture and in the commentaries. Since their houses had been destroyed, they would build bigger, better, and finer ones. So, too, it came out in the words of those attempting to rebuild Ground Zero. One of the nation's most prominent real estate magnates said this of the proposed project: "We should have the World Trade Center bigger and better." From the commentaries on ancient Israel: "If they ruin our houses, we will repair them and make them stronger and finer than they were before." From the American magnate on the rebuilding of Ground Zero: "What I want to see built is the World Trade Center, stronger, and maybe a story taller. You see, Noriel, even if by just as little as one story, it was not about rebuilding, it was about defiance, just as it was in ancient Israel. From the commentaries on the meaning behind Israel's rebuilding, they are determined to withstand God and rebuild on an even grander scale. Now, in the words of one observer, the meaning behind the rebuilding of Ground Zero: the developer who holds the lease has vowed that the towers will rise again. It would show us defiant in the face of terror, unbowed, climbing again, gleaming into the sky, taller, bigger, stronger. Notice the wording, unbowed, climbing into the sky, taller, bigger, stronger, defiant. In other words, the rebuilding of Ground Zero, the tower, would be the embodiment of a defiant nation, just as in Isaiah 9:10. He even used the word vowed. Correct, it was a vow and a boast. In fact, for a time, they even boasted that the tower of Ground Zero would overshadow every other building on earth, Isaiah 9:10 to the extreme. And what happened to that boast? It would ultimately be thwarted. But that's how it began. The rebuilding of Ground Zero was supposed to have resulted in the tallest building in the world. A question, I said. I understand the tower as a symbol of the reconstruction, but is there any place in Isaiah that actually speaks of a tower? Centuries before the writing of the New Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures were translated into Greek. The result was a Greek version of the Hebrew Scriptures called the Septuagint. The Septuagint version of Isaiah 9:10 renders the rebuilding project in even more specific terms. It says this: the bricks are fallen down, but come, let us build for ourselves a tower. How does this happen? I asked. How does it all come together? The words of the leaders, the vows, the tower. It's amazing, as if it's all part of some kind of reenactment. The reenactment of an ancient drama of judgment, he answered. A reenactment in which none of the players have any idea they're doing it. With that, he became silent. We both gazed out into the vast expanse that surrounded us, now darker and more aglow with lights. And so, he said, breaking the silence, out of the ruins of the nation's calamity emerges the fourth harbinger, the most colossal of harbingers, a tower, and the most soaring testament of defiance ever to stand on American soil. And again he became silent, and just stood there on the deck, in the wind, looking out into the lights and darkness of the cityscape. A strange beauty when you look at it from here, he remarked softly. Then he opened his hand. The seal of the fifth harbinger. I took it, examined it, then placed it in my pocket. What can you tell me about it? I asked. It's a harbinger of foundations. Where do I find it? Away from here. You're sure you're not giving away too much information? Far away from here. Chapter 9. The Fifth Harbinger. The Gazit Stone. So what was on the seal, she asked. An irregular line, ascending and descending. I took it to be the top of a mountain. And where did that lead you? I looked at Isaiah 9, but there was nothing there about a mountain. I couldn't find anything to connect the seal to the prophecy, much less to 9/11. Again, I found myself at a roadblock, going nowhere, until I went deeper, deeper, into the prophecy. The last harbinger focused on the word rebuild. But we will rebuild. Yes, we will rebuild, but with what? I focused on the next word. But we will rebuild with hewn stone. But I thought that was part of the mystery of the tower, that they would replace what was destroyed with something greater and stronger than before. It was. But the prophecy specifically speaks about a stone, a hewn stone. Yes, but it was originally written in Hebrew. That's where I went deeper. I looked up the Hebrew behind the word stone. And? The word is gazit. It could be called the gazit stone. It can be translated as a hewn stone, a carved stone, a dressed stone, a smooth stone, a cut stone, or a quarried stone. The Gazit stone was most specifically a stone quarried, chiseled, and carved out of mountain rock. Mountain rock, she said, as if proud to have come up with the discovery. There's your connection. Exactly. And after being quarried, it would be leveled, smoothed, and shaped into a block for use in building, a building block. After the Assyrian attack, the people of Israel would set out to rebuild. They would go to the mountains and quarries to carve, shape, and smooth the Gazit stone. Then they would bring it back to where the bricks had fallen so the rebuilding could begin. So you actually put the clues together correctly. I believe it was the first time I did, a major accomplishment. Where did it lead you? Nowhere. It led me nowhere. I was able to connect the stone to the mountain, but nothing else. There was nothing connecting it to now. No connection to America. How many new buildings in this city do they build out of mountain stone? There was no link. So what did you do? I took a break. I took a break from trying to figure it out, and from the city. I went upstate. There's a cabin there by a lake that I rent. I had several projects to work on, so I got away. So you put the search behind you? The search, yes, but not the seal. I didn't want to leave that behind. So what happened? For the first 2 days, nothing. It was uneventful. Then on the third day, I was out driving, to nowhere in particular, just to drive in the countryside. That's when I saw it, on my left, in the distance. That's when you saw what? A mountain. There had to be a lot of mountains upstate, but this one looked familiar. I pulled over and got out of the car. I reached into my pocket to look at the seal, and it matched. The mountain matched the image on the seal, she said, with obvious disbelief. It was the same shape, the same outline, the same mountain. But I thought the seal was ancient, from the Middle East. How could it match a mountain in America? I don't know. Maybe it was the image of another mountain, some mountain in the Middle East that happened to match the mountain I saw that day. I don't know, but it matched. But for that to happen, the image would not only have had to match the mountain, but the view from which you saw the mountain. How could that happen? How could any of it happen? He said, as if expecting her to by now take such things for granted. How could I keep meeting him each time? Some kind of destiny or predestination, something. Anyway, it matched, or it appeared to match, the moment I first saw it, and from the very spot from which I saw it. So you pursued it. Of course. I drove up the mountain as far as I could drive, then went on foot the rest of the way. And what did you find? I figured that whatever I was supposed to find would be on the mountaintop. But the mountain was long and rolling and was covered with trees. It was hard to know where to look, not to mention what exactly I was looking for. I was there for hours, from midday to the late afternoon. And then, in the late afternoon, I finally found what I was supposed to find, which was him. I found him. The first thing I noticed was the coat, that long, dark coat flapping with each gust of wind. He was standing there by one of the edges of the mountaintop, looking out into the distance. He was often doing that, looking out into the distance, right? Yes, and now it was into a vast open landscape of distant blue mountains, all different shades of blue blending into each other, something you'd see in a watercolor. And he just happened to be there when you happened to be there. And you just happened to be there only because you just happened to be driving by that particular place that day. And you just happened to see the mountain from a view that just happened to match the image of the mountain on the seal. She paused and stared at him with a light smile before adding, "It all just happened to happen." "That's pretty much it," he replied. "And how far away was the mountain from the city?" "Several hours north." "How did he—" "Don't even try." So I approached him. I was within 10 feet of him when he spoke. "So how was your vacation, Nouriel?" he asked without looking back. "You know, I promised myself I wasn't going to ask how you do all this. But how long have you been here? On this mountain? On this spot?"
"Not long. Just enough to be here before you came. I didn't want to keep you waiting.
That wouldn't be polite. But of course. So, you had a pleasant vacation? I'm still in the midst of it, and I'm not sure. I was now standing at his side, near the edge, facing him. He would alternate his gaze between me and the light blue mountains in the distance. So, what have you found so far? He asked. On the fifth harbinger? Not a lot. Then let's start with a little. What have you found? After the attack, the nation vows to rebuild, not with clay bricks, as before, but with stone. In the prophecy, the Hebrew word for stone is gazit. Well done, Noriel. You're going deeper. That's good. What else? Gazit speaks of stone that's been cut out, chiseled, in particular, quarried from mountain rock, thus the mountain on the seal, a place from which the gazit stone is quarried. That's more than a little. But it doesn't lead me anywhere. It led you here. But what does it have to do with America? Or with the tower? It's not as if New York City is about to build skyscrapers out of quarried stones. Piece the clues together, Noriel. Then we can see if there's any connection to America. Where are we in the prophecy? But we will rebuild with hewn stone. So they vowed to rebuild, and to do so stronger than before, to replace the fallen clay bricks with the gazit stone. They quarry their stones, carve them into massive blocks, and bring them back to the ground of destruction, to where the bricks have fallen. The first stone of building is always the most important, the cornerstone. The laying down of the cornerstone begins the construction. It's not just a necessary act, but a symbolic one. And in the case of Israel's rebuilding, the laying down of the first gazit stone would be filled with symbolic meaning, signaling the beginning of the nation's rebuilding and the fulfillment of its vow. May I have the seal? So I handed it to him, and he lifted it up as he revealed its meaning. The fifth harbinger. The nation responds to the calamity with defiance in the form of stone. The stone is cut out of their mountains and bedrock. They chisel it into a block. They bring it back to the ground of destruction. The stone becomes a symbol, the embodiment of their vow, their confidence, and their defiance. Upon the stone they rest their plans of rebuilding and their vow of national resurgence. But the gazit stone is, in reality, a symbol of a nation's rejection of God's calling. When the sign of the gazit stone manifests, it's a harbinger, carrying a warning of future calamity. The fifth harbinger, the gazit stone. And what does it have to do with America? They came here, Noriel. They came here to find the gazit stone. Here, I asked. Here to the mountains. They came here and cut it out of the mountain rock and brought it back. Back? Back to where the bricks had fallen. To ground zero? Yes. For the vow declares the bricks have fallen, but we will rebuild with quarried stone. So the rebuilding must begin on the same site of the destruction. So the gazit stone must be brought to where the bricks had fallen, to the ground of the calamity. Thus the quarried stone had to be brought back to ground zero. And so it was. And what happened at ground zero once they brought it back? There was a gathering there, a gathering of leaders, the mayor of New York City, the governor of New York State, the governor of New Jersey, various officials involved with the rebuilding, other leaders, and a gathering of guests and spectators. They were all focused on a single object, the gazit stone. The gazit stone most often took the form of a massive rectangular block of cut rock. So too the stone that was laid on the pavement of ground zero. A massive rectangular block of quarried stone laid at ground zero. A 20-ton massive rectangular block of quarried stone. The stone was to mark the beginning of the rebuilding. But we will rebuild with quarried stone. Exactly, the stone of Isaiah's prophecy was another symbol of national defiance. So, too, they made the gazit stone of ground zero into a symbol. They even gave it a name. They called it the Freedom Stone. It was created to be the symbolic cornerstone of the rebuilding, not just of ground zero, but of New York City and America. Its laying down was to be the first act in that rebuilding and the beginning of the tower that was to rise up from the site. So, as in the last days of ancient Israel, the Gazit stone would again become the symbol of a nation's rebuilding and restoration. Were there any such proclamations or vows spoken, I asked, when the Gazit stone was laid at ground zero? Why do you ask that? Because the stone in Isaiah 9:10 was linked to the proclaiming of the vow. There were such proclamations, and as in the ancient case, their proclamations joined the nation's rebuilding to the quarried stone. Their words were, in effect, a modern paraphrase of the ancient vow. On ground zero, the American leaders declared that they too would rebuild with quarried stone. The stone, they declared, would be the beginning of the nation's rebuilding. It would forever remain a symbolic cornerstone for the rebuilding of New York and the nation. As it was in ancient Israel, the act of rebuilding with quarried stone was intended to send a message. So the governor of New York would proclaim, "By laying this magnificent cornerstone of hope, we are sending a message to the people around the world." A message of defiance. Yes, a message of defiance. On one hand, a defiance of the calamity, but on the other, beneath the surface, something much deeper, a much deeper defiance, just as it was with ancient Israel. One commentary explains it this way. Far from being humbled and becoming repentant as a result of the chastening judgments of the Lord, they are resolutely determined to withstand God and rebuild on an even grander scale. The bricks have crumbled, but we will rebuild with stone cut out of the quarry. Stone cut out of the quarry. Just as the rebuilding of Ground Zero and of America involved the stone cut out of the quarry here. Yes, and even the New York governor would allude to the stone cut out of the quarry as he spoke his proclamation over the stone. Today, we take 20 tons of Adirondack granite, the bedrock of our state, and place it as the foundation, the bedrock of a new symbol of American strength and confidence. As it was with ancient Israel, the quarried stone would become the embodiment of a nation's misplaced confidence in its own power to emerge stronger than before. And the act of laying down the quarried stone would be a manifestation of what the commentaries call the spirit of defiance. The bricks may have fallen down. It was of no consequence. They would build with hewn stone. Thus they breathed the very spirit of defiance. The nation determines to act in a spirit of defiance. It will turn its fallen bricks into massive stones. The spirit of defiance, why is that significant? On the day that America officially began its rebuilding by replacing the fallen bricks of 9/11 with the Gazit stone, the governor of New York would make a proclamation from the floor of Ground Zero. Listen to the words. Today, we, the heirs of that revolutionary spirit of defiance, lay this cornerstone. He used those exact words? Those exact words. The same words and the same act, the quarried stone and the spirit of defiance, joined together. Unbelievable. The thing is so, it is, but it happened. The ancient drama reenacted on Ground Zero. And what happened after, I asked, after the stone was laid? What happened after was especially striking. The rebuilding of Ground Zero had already become tangled in a continual stream of controversy, confusion, obstacles, dissension, and conflict. Even after the stone was set in place, the tower's construction would be challenged, halted, redrawn, renamed, and reversed. The plans to rebuild Ground Zero would be frustrated for years. Eventually, they would remove the stone from Ground Zero altogether. Strange, I said. They removed the cornerstone, and after all those words. Strange and not so strange. The plans of ancient Israel to defiantly rebuild itself would likewise be frustrated. It would ultimately lead the nation to the point of destruction. The laying down of the Gazit stone was one more link in a chain of judgment. The commentary goes on to reveal what it all leads to. It will turn its fallen bricks into massive stones that will not fail. It was to be followed with fearful penalty, to be pressed on every hand by its enemies, to be prepared for still impending miseries. The defiance of God shuts out immeasurable good. It's a replaying. It's all replaying itself, the whole thing. It's so uncanny, and they had no idea what they were doing. That they were reenacting the ancient prophecy? No. And yet they each ended up stepping into the ancient footsteps. It was a prophetic act taking place according to the mystery. So what does it all portend for America's future? If those who came to Ground Zero that day to issue their proclamations had realized what it all portended, they would have stayed home. He reached into his coat pocket and gave me the next seal. The seal of the sixth harbinger, I said. And this is... The image is clear enough, he said, as is the prophecy. This one shouldn't be hard to uncover. Still, some help would be appreciated. The sixth harbinger appeared the same day as the first, and in the same place of the one that came after it. Well, that really clears everything up, I replied. And to think, I was worried you wouldn't be specific enough this time. Nouriel? Yes? Have a great rest of your vacation. And with that, he left me there, standing at the edge of the mountain. I'm sure I will, I answered in a raised voice. Try to get some rest, he responded as he walked. Rest is good. And of course I'll be sure to bring you back a souvenir, I shouted. Just the seal, Nouriel. Just bring back the seal. And with that, he disappeared into the woods.